We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Pledge Drive. You can give online at willpledge.org.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Over the last month, there's been an explosion, first in Lower Manhattan, then across the United States, now across the world. It started as Occupy Wall Street, and now it's pretty much Occupy the Planet. One of the biggest news stories we've had in a long time here, and I've been flooded with requests to cover it. So today, we've got two journalists who've been hot on the beat. Going to join us for the full hour, at least one of them the full hour, the other for a portion of the show, who've been on the ground in New York to tell us what's been going on there and to take your questions. Until then, before we get to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
It's now 3 weeks into the Occupy Wall Street protests, where hundreds of people have camped out in New York City's financial district to object to a financial system they say is widening the wealth divide in the U.S. Finally, after an embarrassingly poor show of news coverage, the establishment media is beginning to pick up the story. But increased airtime and column inches doesn't necessarily equal quality reporting. Media watchdog groups like Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting say stories have been short on actual facts and long on criticism of a protest the media have failed to explain. Independent journalist Allison Kilkenny, co-producer of the political radio show Citizen Radio, has been tracking the mainstream media's coverage of the movement. One central critique by the media that seems to warrant scant coverage is that the protest doesn't have a unified vision.
If Occupy Wall Street has done nothing else, it's allowed us to see how incredibly lazy and inept our media is, because they really don't understand how to cover this movement.
Rather than reporting on the protest as a legitimate movement and interviewing an array of activists, Kilkenny says the media has spent a lot of time belittling it, from mocking activist clothes to jabbing at drum circles.
So Americans should be angry in the sense that this is the only kind of meaningful resistance that has emerged ever since corporations robbed the country blind. And now here we are when there's finally a legitimate response to it. And what are they saying? Oh, they're hippies in a drum circle. Well, you know, I believe that the role of journalism should be to help us understand the world around us and how it works. That doesn't help me understand anything, making fun of what people wear.
Kilkenny says this type of news coverage highlights the problems with the corporate-owned media system. It's designed to defend, rather than report on, the corporations that fund it.
So when you have Erin Burnett on CNN being very dismissive of Occupy Wall Street, we have to ask ourselves, okay, who's Erin Burnett? And if you look into her resume, I mean, she's been a shill for Citigroup for many, many years. It's not surprising that someone who is herself a corporate shill and is on a network that has corporate advertisers would not depict Occupy Wall Street in the most favorable light.
To listen to more reporting about the protests and the media coverage from Allison Kilkenny, visit wearecitizenradio.com. For more information about the protests, visit occupytogether.org.
Corporate opponents of net neutrality have been arguing that rules protecting an open internet will stifle innovation and economic growth, but a new study says that is just plain false. New York University Law School's nonpartisan Institute for Policy Integrity says that the internet generates huge economic benefits for consumers, as much as $5,600 per user per year. Executive Director Mike Livermore explains that the infrastructure of the net, the wires, cables, and other hardware, and the content that flows through that hardware combine to create value for the user. Livermore says that without net neutrality rules to keep the internet an open level playing field for everyone who uses it, the value to users could diminish.
If ISPs are allowed
to discriminate on the basis of content or prioritize some content and not others, it really throws off some of the incentives for investment away from where we might want it to be.
It's fine for infrastructure and content providers to make a profit, Livermore says. The task for Congress and the FCC is to make rules to keep profit incentives towards benefiting consumers. On an open internet with net neutrality rules, service providers must make a profit by investing in infrastructure and competing on speed and price. Content providers must invest in high-quality, accessible products. And innovators are free to jump in and move the industry forward with new and exciting applications and products. Without clear rules of the road, service and content providers can conspire to keep access at a premium. They can make deals to squeeze out possible competitors, and they can make their profits by charging for priority access. There will be no incentive for providers to invest in faster speeds, more access, or better products. And that would decrease the value of the internet for users. The Senate is about to take up a resolution of disapproval passed by the House earlier this year that would kill the FCC's net neutrality rules and strip away the agency's power to regulate the internet. Livermore is worried about the possibility of a lawless net.
We're talking about a lot of value that's created for end users and ultimately for the American economy. So the stakes are very high. And if we get it wrong and undermine the incentives to invest in content and infrastructure, there's a lot on the line. We stand to lose quite a bit.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today. This October 16th, 2011, here on WILL AM 580, we have a show I've been looking forward to. For the last 2 weeks, I've gotten numerous emails, telephone calls, personal conversations from listeners asking me to do a program on Occupy Wall Street and the Occupy Wall Street movement nationally and internationally. And this week, we scrambled together a show, and I'm delighted to say we got just about our first two choices to go on. We'll be joined today later by Laura Flanders, for the host of the Laura Flanders Show on television. That'll be starting up on public stations this fall, currently the host of Grit TV. Laura will be joining us in the middle of the program. In the meantime, for the full hour, I'm just absolutely delighted to have as our guest someone who's been on the show many times before, Greg Mitchell, who served as the editor of Editor and Publisher Magazine, the trade publication of the newspaper industry, from 2002 to 2009, author of numerous books, and now currently at TheNation.com, where he has the blog Occupy USA, and he's been following a number of stories very closely with the blog. In addition, in particular, the WikiLeaks story has done the best work on that in the United States, as far as I'm concerned. So it's a real honor to have Greg. He is also an author who's written several books, and for present purposes, two that have just come out in ebook shape are Dead Reckoning and also Atomic Cover-Up, both an ebook and is in print. Greg Mitchell, thank you so much for taking time from your weekend to join us today.
Well, thank you, Bob. And even while I was on hold, I posted another item of my Occupy blog at The Nation. So
yeah, I'm going through your blog. So yeah, I see that. This is quite extraordinary. And just for folks should know that, Greg, you've been blogging this literally almost around the clock for some time now. And the place to go is just go to thenation.com and you'll click right through to Greg Mitchell and the Occupy USA blog.
Yeah, I've been doing it. I mean, I wrote about it early on, you know, a month ago. But I started the sort of semi-live blog with constant updates a little over 2 weeks ago. So it's about 15 days in, I guess, and it's dozens and dozens of items every day, videos. There's been all kinds of incredible videos from protests, some showing police action, some showing other things, including people like Tom Morello showing up to sing. And so there's no shortage of videos. There's no shortage of things to link to, just a lot of tremendous writing and observing out there. And even, following Twitter is really the way to go in following the ongoing actions. And even now live streaming, you know, the big change from back in our day when we were protesting Vietnam and all the everything that followed after that, where you kind of had to rely on the mainstream media. Now you not only have, you know, blogs and websites and Twitter, but and Facebook, but you also have live stream from various individuals and organizations that cover the demonstrations, cover the police conflicts and so forth in real time, and you can, you know, you can watch as these things happen, and also people upload things to YouTube in a matter of minutes. So it's, you know, you could do a full hour on the differences in this movement and the differences in the media coverage of this movement versus movements even, you know, 10 years ago.
Well, let's start, though, if we can, Greg Mitchell, just for listeners who are, you know a little bit about what's going on, like all Americans or many Americans now do, but have not necessarily been tweeting about it or going on Twitter and haven't really even been to your website, your blog at Occupy USA, and have just heard a few things about it. I don't really know much about it.
Right.
What would you start, how would you describe this in you know, a minute or two, just to someone who's just sort of coming to the scene and wants to know what's going on here?
Right. Well, it really started, you know, to just do a mini history, it really started in Europe, where there's been more activity in the streets about the economy's falling apart there as much as it has here. But there was, you know, much more action in the streets over there. So kind of the germ was planted, and then starting this summer, it really started, the Adbusters magazine started promoting it, and it started really only about a month or so ago, with this very small occupation group forming, demonstrating, and starting to stay in that park.
How big is that park, if I can ask?
It's actually quite small. I think it would surprise a lot of people. And it's all concrete, you know, and it's very close to ground zero.
Mm-hmm.
It's very close to Wall Street. It was picked because it's close to Wall Street. It's also about two blocks from ground zero in New York and lower Manhattan. It's there's a fascinating story about it. It's considered a private park, but the given to or a corporation that had for the usual variants to build a higher skyscraper had to take over this park. And if you ever see the reference to it as Zuccotti Park, well, it used to be Liberty Park. It was renamed Zuccotti because he was running the company that owns the skyscraper, and so they have to manage the park. So it's often described as a private park, but really it's sort of a public park because it was mandated to serve the public. But it's just a block long. It's actually fairly narrow. It's surprisingly small, and of course now it's utterly packed with people, leading them now to start to consider moving elsewhere. But the mini history basically was it started really about a month ago, and it was not taken seriously by the media or pundits or politicians. They were very dismissive of it, and then lo and behold, it stuck around. It got more support. Labor unions started endorsing it, and so you literally had a number of writers who had dismissed it early on. Within 2 weeks, they were writing columns and going on TV and say, you know, I was wrong, which, you know, is a very rare thing.
Very.
For pundits. Actually, I was wrong about these people. Maybe I have some problems with some of what they say, or, you know, the too much drumming going on in the park. But, you know, what they're doing is so important to raise these issues, and we don't even quite know what their demands are. We don't know where this is going to lead. But the fact they're doing something, you know, in America has been so quiet. You know, some people on the left have been critical of Obama and critical of the Democrats for caving in on so many things. But it was very just, you know, complaints, you know, on the web, and so these people, mainly younger people, really crystallized everything and took a stand, and they've, you know, continued to take a stand and risked arrest and have had arrests. And I was at the Times Square demonstrations yesterday, which was just incredible. Beyond all expectations, really.
Yeah, and I want you to talk about Times Square, Greg Mitchell. But before you get to that, some sense of down at Zuccotti Park and at the ground zero, so to speak, of the demonstrations in Lower Manhattan. You know, what are the demographics? Who's there?
Right.
What sort of folks are there? And what's the sort of esprit de corps of the morale?
Well, the morale is incredible. Now, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I go back to demonstrations to the 1960s, showing my age there, but it's quite different than anything. You know, it is mainly younger people. It is, at least in New York, and again, we should emphasize this is now spread to hundreds of cities in the U.S. and inspired people around the globe. You know, they had 500,000 people in Madrid yesterday.
And there is an amazing clip of that on your blog,
yeah,
I should say.
Yeah. Beethoven in Madrid.
Absolutely astonishing at the Occupy USA blog.
Yeah, but it has, you know, sort of inspired by abroad, but now has inspired abroad. And, of course, in hundreds of U.S. cities, I mean, I try to chronicle on the blog, although I suppose it has had a New York focus, what's going on in all these other cities, and it's fascinating. You know, there were 46 people arrested in Phoenix yesterday, which you wouldn't necessarily expect. You know, of course, we know there were a lot of arrests in Chicago last night, but it's fascinating to see, you know, when there's big arrests in Raleigh, North Carolina, and so forth. So it has fanned out from there. So, but the New York, you know, we don't want to overemphasize New York, but as you mentioned, it is sort of ground zero in the movement, and it has inspired the stand that people took there. You know, as some of your listeners may know, there was just an incredible episode this week, which probably has meant more than almost anything this week, is that they were going to be kicked out of the park. And they sent word out for people to come down there to protect the park and risk arrest. And, you know, thousands and thousands of people showed up in the middle of the night in the rain, including a lot of union people were ordered to go down there. And so, lo and behold, 6 o'clock in the morning when the action was supposed to begin, there's like 3,000 people in the park, many of them willing to risk arrest. And of course, the mayor and the company that owns the park backed down. And so it was one of the most inspiring things you could see, and it's led to more actions around the country and the world.
Now, yesterday afternoon in Times Square, there was, you just already alluded to, mentioned there was a demonstration as well. And for those not familiar with New York City, Times Square is up in Midtown in the 40s on the west side. So that's a few miles away from from Wall Street.
Right.
And how did that go? What was that all about? Who organized it, and what was it like? You were there.
Well, it was a typical action for these people. They left the park, marched through Wall Street, you know, against, you know, police orders, but they did it. They marched up to, I joined them marching up to Washington Square Park, where they had a big rally, and a lot of students joined in. Then they marched up 6th Avenue to Times Square, kind of, fencing off with the police at different points to be able to keep going. And then they joined the people already gathered at Times Square at 5 o'clock. And the Times Square layout is hard to describe because where people can go there is basically a series of triangles.
Yeah, I mean, there's really not a square. It's not like a square at all.
It's like four blocks of triangles.
Small ones, too.
The people just utterly filled the triangles. Traffic kept flowing, but they utterly filled the triangles for four blocks and utterly filled the sidewalks and some of the side streets. So they say there were 20,000 or 30,000 just there. And it was just a very, you know, joyous and loud chanting crowd. And then there was some police actions near the end, but it wasn't too bad. Maybe 40, 45, or 50 arrested, but it could have been a lot worse. Another major, major way this movement is so different from the past, and some people may find this difficult, especially if you're a little older persuasion, is, you know, they claim to have no real leaders. It's incredibly democratic. They have daily what they call general assemblies where practically anyone can get up and speak. They go on forever. But it's incredibly democratic. They don't have people that you can go for a spoke. You know, you go to the spokesman or you go to the leader for the media to get the quote. Well, there's no one to go to. You know, there is a press table that can direct you to some people who maybe have been active for a while. So it's been difficult for the media to get a handle on it because you don't go to the spokesman or the leader or assistant leader or whatever. So it's quite a different experience. And the other thing is they don't use public address systems. They don't have the stages where people go and stand in front of a microphone and talk. They have what they call the human, the people's mic.
Yeah, anyone who's seen it, once you've seen it, it's sort of very striking, and you don't need an explanation. For those who haven't seen it, maybe you could explain how the people's mic works.
Well, whoever has the rostrum, shouts, starts speaking or shouting out, and after about every sentence or less than a sentence, half of a sentence, he or she pauses, and then the people near the front shout out what they said, and then the people behind them shout out. So it kind of goes through the crowd. So if you're in the middle or back of a crowd, you can hear everything that's said from the speaker passed along by other people, and it slows things down. But it's very democratic. Everyone can join. Yeah, actually, the process of being part of that microphone brings people together, and is part of this symbolism, I guess, of democracy. And it's really quite different. It adds. Now, I suppose if this movement goes on, and they get, they go into a different phase. I'm not sure that they're against the use of microphones and public address systems, and I don't know if they will ever have a large rally where they have a stage and people come out and play music and speak into a microphone. That may happen, but for now, it's copied around the world. We see this around the world. We see the same things going on around the world. So it's sort of a whole new idea.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Greg Mitchell, former editor and publisher for many years, over the past decade, currently working at thenation.com, where he is blogging extensively right now on the Occupy USA blog there. Updated probably while you've been talking. It wouldn't surprise me if you haven't. Okay. Last update about 15 minutes ago. And you should go there. Go to thenation.com. You'll click right through to the Occupy USA blog. Greg Mitchell's also blogged on WikiLeaks as well as anyone in the United States, and I want to get to that. In fact, before Laura Flanders joins us in a few minutes, let's talk about WikiLeaks specifically, because I was at one of the Occupy events, and one of the speakers stood up yesterday and said, basically, we owe a lot of this to WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning to sort of expose what our government's doing and really make people more aware of it. And
well,
you're the one person who's covered both, so what do you take on that?
Well, it was interesting yesterday morning, bringing my two interests together, when Julian Assange went to the London Stock Exchange occupation and was briefly detained. He was actually wearing one of those V for Vendetta masks, and he was actually detained, and he was finally released, and he spoke, and people can find online, there's links to video of him and so on and so forth. So, and he certainly was hailed as kind of a hero or something over there, for his work. And, he certainly tried to draw it together. I'm not quite sure. I mean, I think there's some connection. I wouldn't go that far. I think this would have happened without WikiLeaks. I think WikiLeaks has had a big impact in a lot of areas, foreign policy areas, Iraq and Afghanistan, revelations about the U.S. State Department, revelation about the U.S. policy abroad and some of our allies. And obviously, I blogged it for like 6 months every day, so I believe in the importance of it. But I'm not sure making the connection to Occupy, I wouldn't make too much of that.
Our number here at Media Matters, if someone would like to call in to speak with Greg Mitchell, question or comment, and we have Laura Flanders joining us shortly, is 333-9455. Our toll-free line is open at 1-800-222-4700. 1-800-222-9455. We'll probably get to questions in a few minutes in the second half of the show. Right now, I just want to clear up a few matters with Greg Mitchell, get some more stuff covered. One of the big stories that I have seen attention given to has been in New York and elsewhere, too, obviously, but in New York specifically, the relationship of the police to the protesters.
Right.
And what is your sense of what has happened and why is it happening?
Well, it's, you know, again, we've all got, going back forever, the stories about protests and policemen. You know, there's always conflict. I think these protesters are bending over backwards to, as they say, welcome the police as part of, you know, what they call the 99%.
Well, sort of the Wisconsin model from the winter.
Yeah, if you are, we are you, or you are us, or... We are, you know, they chant, we're fighting for your pensions, we're fighting for your pensions. They often plead with them in a personal way along the, you know, along the barricades. So more than any movement I've been part of, there is much, much more reaching out to police, giving police the benefit of the doubt, trying to work with them, seeing them as, you know, part of their movement, potentially. On the other hand, the police do... serve authority, police do kind of often talk nicely, but then they're ready to charge. You know, in Times Square yesterday, there were police in riot gear. There were police with on horseback charging into the crowd at times. So, you know, they have a job to do, and they often say, yeah, I wish, you know, I'm with you, or I'm tired, you know, you know, I'm tired, I want to go home. But so there's that conflict. But I think there's, you know, there is you know, legitimate sympathy there, maybe on both sides, and it probably does something to keep the violence down. We've seen many videos of police attacks now, but that's, you know, certainly the minority. And,
I mean, so if someone were, yeah, because if you only see the videos that are shown, that's your sole exposure to the demonstrations, you would think this is like Chicago in 1968 and some crazy cops are just pounding on protesters.
Right.
And that's not the case, in other words.
Well, it happens. It has happened. but there's been an awful lot of conflicts where it looks like it's going to happen. I felt that in Times Square yesterday, then, you know, that something really bad could happen any moment. But there's a lot of restraint. You know, there's always people looking for a fight in any of these type of crowds. There's always people who are, you know, pushing the envelope. But, you know, this movement is avowedly nonviolent. And they, you know, at most you have people who feel we should be able to march where we want, or they get their backup when they're not allowed to, you know, march, you know, where they want to march and make their point. And then you may have people willing to be arrested in civil disobedience. But there's certainly not, there's been almost no rock throwing or, you know, breaking windows. You know, virtually none around the country. There's virtually hardly any incidents at all of any sort of violence, even minor violence. So, you know, let's hope that can continue.
Greg Mitchell, I was talking with someone I know yesterday, who's a historian of social movements in the American left and a veteran of 1960s activism, student and anti-war activism. And he told me that, in his view, this is the most interesting, most dynamic, most original, social movements he's seen in the United States in 40 years. I was just wondering, given your vantage point, what's your take?
Well, it's you know, you have to give it time. You know, there's been a lot. Each of these movements is different, and this one is, you know, it's quite different. Of course, we have a quite different world today with the social,
well, let me,
social media.
In fairness to his comment, I think his point was connecting it to the Wisconsin uprising earlier, sort of seeing it as sort of the next chapter of what began in Madison.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. Again, I think most of the people, at least the people who've been at this for a while in this movement, I'm not even sure how many of them were aware of Madison. You know, I mean, these are mainly younger people who are partly idealistic, partly very concerned about their futures. Some and many of them out of work because of the economy, many of them with staggering student debt. So certainly they have no background in unions or anything like that. So a lot of them, I'm not quite sure how much Madison inspired them.
Well, I'll tell you what, Greg, let me, I'm going to put you on hold right now because apparently we're going to bring Laura Flanders in just a second, and I need to turn you down, and then we'll get back to this issue, and Laura will join us momentarily. So in the meantime, I just want to let all our listeners know that 1 week from today, we will be in our special two-hour pledge drive program of Media Matters, and John Nichols will be here live with me for the full 2 hours. And John's been in New York. John's covering politics, as all of you know, like few other people do. And we'll have two hours talking politics with John Nichols. We're also going to be talking to people at the Occupy Wall Street protests. We're going to have one person who's been doing the media there call in and talk with us and give us a report. It should be a wonderful two-hour show. I think you'll look forward to it. And this also seems like a good time right now to I'd like to make a special tribute if I can. This show, Media Matters, is approaching its 10th year, and I think listeners to it, and many of you call from all over the world and are familiar with the program and all over the United States. There's nothing quite like it on any other NPR affiliate in the United States. Much to my regret, I was hoping other stations would see the success we've had here at WILL and emulate it and find someone in their community to do a program like this, because there is clearly such a great interest in programming like this. And the reason why this is the only NPR station that picked up a program like this, supported it, stuck with it, endorsed it, and has really embraced it, is largely due to a gentleman named Jay Pierce. And Jay is the reason this show got put on the air, and he's been at every pledge drive from the beginning, working the board with me. And Jay Pierce has left WILL, much to my regret and the regret of everyone in the community who knows him, to take a new position as general manager of WVIK-FM, Augustana Public Radio in the Quad Cities at 90.3 FM and 95.9 in Dubuque, Iowa. And I just want to say thank you to Jay Pierce for everything he's done for this show, for making it possible. And I want everyone listening to the show to understand what a crucial role Jay Pierce has played in making the show available at all and that it exists to this day. So thank you very much, Jay. I think we have our two guests now both back on the phone lines. Greg Mitchell, of course, and Laura Flanders, are you there?
I am.
Well, Laura, thank you, too, for taking time from your incredibly busy schedule to speak with us. Our listeners are keenly interested in what's happening in Occupy Wall Street and Occupy in America. And I just, before we go to the phone lines, I just wanted to ask you, Laura, for someone who hasn't, you've been there, most of our listeners have not, and, you know, what would you say is most striking to you about what's been taking place over the last 2 or 3 weeks?
What's been taking place that is most striking to me, Bob, is that you go day after day and it is still there. You know, for a progressive populace that have come to become very kind of gun-shy of hope and of really believing in possible change, to have a protest with visible form survive 1 week of being ignored, 2 weeks of being ignored, 3 weeks of being ignored and pretty brutally repressed by local police, gave people hope. And I think in that third week, the week after the march across the Brooklyn Bridge, the week after the tear gassing of the tear gassing of the pepper spraying of the young women near Washington Square, the hope, it broke through a dam, I think, that we've built up of self-protection. I'm not going to go there again. I am not going to believe this protest is just going to fade away. I don't want to be tricked one more time. I'm not going to be Charlie Brown at Lucy's football one more time. I think the fact that they've survived this long and are now well into their, I think, fifth week, at least fourth, that's the most significant thing to me, the longevity of it already and the confidence that has built up that this is actually something that can permit a lot of people around this country to take one more kick at the football.
Laura, you have been covering progressive politics for a long time and written about it in your books for a long time. You've probably had your ear to the ground on grassroots politics very closely for the work you've been doing for the last decade. Have you been, what do you make of the fact that this has sort of exploded in literally hundreds of demonstrations across the United States, not to mention the world?
Well, I think it's exactly that. I think that once people got it, that this was here for a little bit, that this was something that they dared get behind, there was an explosion of everything that has been in waiting. I mean, you're right. I wrote a book in 2006 that was about what I believed was brewing in the country that wasn't yet all that visible and came to be the kind of skeletal progressive infrastructure that produced the Barack Obama for President campaign. It wasn't the idea of a lot of the progressive groups that were that I wrote about in my book, but it was the outcome, in the sense that I wrote about in 2006, and you remember this story, just believing that the results of that 2004-2006 elections were not accurate reflections of progressive sentiment in the country. They were reflections of a really poorly operating Democratic Party, a really corrupt electoral system, vote suppression, you name it, media manipulation, all of the above, and that there was more going on in the country that met the eye. I think in 2008, a lot of that progressive mobilization, we're talking local grassroots groups that were working on issues of LGBT liberation and of economic rights and of, you know, alternative sentencing and immigration reform. They threw their weight behind an electoral candidate who looked like he was the long-shot candidate who had some kind of background in community organizing, or at least he used the words and led people to believe that he understood what they did. They got involved in an election campaign. They've watched 2 years go by where a change in the White House didn't make a change in their house, and many of them saw actually losing their houses during that period. They were waiting. I think many people were waiting for a people-driven, priority on people movement that would have a space for them, that would have a sense of outrage as well as a sense of determination, and that would be more than about changing politicians' lives, but really about changing all of our lives and about the culture of greed that we live in and the culture of corruption and just what has happened to our democracy. I mean, we talk about Occupy Wall Street, but in many ways this is an anti-occupation movement. It's a movement in New York that's close to Wall Street, that's a repudiation of the way that the financial industry has come to occupy our lives and our priorities and our dollars and our politicians and really come to corrupt our democracy.
Laura Flanders,
I wasn't at all surprised to see it resonate in a way that, around the country in the way that it did.
We have several callers who've been waiting patiently. I want to get to them straight away. The number again at WILL Media Matters is 333-9455 and our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. I'm going to jump the line. I just want to let Kyle Kroha, the engineer, know to go to the toll-free line first, because I think that there'll be other people wanting to use that line. So let's start with line four. Paris, France, line four, you're on the air with Greg Mitchell and Laura Flanders at Media Matters.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thank you very much. Yeah, proceed.
Good. I saw Noam Chomsky speak last weekend in London at the Rebellious Media Conference, where I also had the pleasure of hearing your long-distance comments, Bob. And in his keynote, he gave an early analysis of Occupy Wall Street. He offered what I thought was some important constructive criticism, which is that any short-term demands that are made need to be realistic and not pie in the sky. Those are my words, not his, because if they're not short-term realistic, it's likely to lead to disillusionment among the people involved, among the protesters, and could actually end up being very counterproductive. So my question is whether your guests had any comment about that, specifically if you had any thoughts about what might be the more reasonable kinds of short-term demands that need to be emphasized right now in contrast to more long-term goals that it wouldn't make as much sense to focus on right now. For example, should corporate personhood be emphasized? Should student loan forgiveness be emphasized?
Okay, well, thank you very much, caller from Paris, France, for joining us. Let's start with Greg Mitchell. Greg, your thoughts on the demands and what should be emphasized and where this is going?
Well, you know, this has been the biggest criticism from people, outsiders, about the movement is the lack of published demands, which they admit they haven't. They've had manifestos, they've had indications of what it seems to bring people together. But they're still working on demands. Part of it is because they demand consensus on everything. You know, 90% of people have to approve everything. But I think I hate to say it's too early, but I think it's been all about building the movement. It's been all about bringing people together, finding out who is willing to commit themselves to this, what seemed to some sort of vague, but actually quite powerful goals, overall goals, and, you know, what they're against. And once they gauge the level of support, the level of commitment, what people are willing to do, how far it extends, then I think that's when they think the demands can come together. And I think also, I think it's a feeling that even before specific demands or before you reach this point of being maybe disenchanted with something not happening, you're nevertheless having a positive effect every day, if nothing else, trying to push the Democratic Party and the White House, you know, to the left or to the not caving in the way they have been. There's some indication that's already worked a little bit. So I think there's probably a feeling that it's having a positive effect already in making people take notice and in making people fear what this could lead to, and that's going to maybe lead to some good things in the meantime.
Laura Flanders, I know I saw you on the Ed Schultz show with my dear friend John Nichols not too long ago on this whole point where Ed Schultz was, I think, to put it accurately, was parlaying the uprising as being almost sort of an Obama campaign rally at Lower Wall Street and around the country, that these were very much Democratic Party, very sympathetic Democratic voters who were coming out to show their dismay. And I was wondering, you know, you've been there, what your take is on the politics of this movement and its relationship to the Obama administration and the Democratic Party.
I want you to tell me how effectively you thought John and I parried off that idea that this is all kind of a Barack Obama backup team.
I thought you guys did it very well.
I think it's important. I mean, I think that you've got certainly, I mean, I think Ed is a wonderful guy, and his ultimate sort of effort at being supportive is to say this is all good pro-Democratic Party, pro-Obama activism, and the Democratic Party need not be scared of it. And that's an important role for him to play. The role that we have to play in the independent media is, I think, to make the points that you're making here, which is, you know, actually, if anything, this is a huge wake-up call to the Democratic Party and to Barack Obama, that maybe there's some opportunity here for him not to entirely miss the bus of popular need and demand in this election cycle. But essentially, the Occupy Wall Street movement is not about the political system, except insofar as it's about changing it. And if there were to be one demand, I think the demand that I would love, and I think this is a kind of projection moment where we all project onto a fairly inchoate, ideologically inchoate movement, the desire of our heart's desire, I would wish that they would coalesce around something like public financing for elections, get corporate money out of our elections, have a people's, you know, an old Declaration of Independence from corporate monopoly, which in a sense is what the original U.S. Declaration of Independence was about. That Tea Party protest was about throwing monopolist tea into the harbor in Boston. It was a rebellion against a marriage between monarchy and a monopoly empire corporation, the East India Company. And if you go back and read the documents of that period, pre-Constitution, that's what it was about. So I think that if, you know, we each probably could come up with one concentrating demand that would make sense. But I think that we're also, many of us, in this position of reacting to mainstream criticism. And I entirely defend the Occupy Wall Street people's right to resist the money media's endless mantra that they need to come up with a message, because we know what that media will do to that message. At the same time, I think that it can't go on forever not having some demands.
And it was, I had an interesting experience last week of a woman being in town whom I wanted to interview about her book. She's somebody who's been an advisor to the Indignado movement in Spain, Loretta Napoleone. You've probably interviewed her, the author of Rogue Economics, among other things. And she compared, I got her into a conversation with one of the people at Wall Street, and she compared what was happening in Spain with what was happening here, and the contrasts were pretty stark. And in that case, she said, this very anonymous, not at all interested in the money media movement in Spain has nonetheless issued almost daily position papers on critical political developments, whether it was free trade pacts or the euro crisis or bailing out Greece or whatever it is. And it did occur to me as I was watching the free trade bill get passed more than one this week, that this Occupy Wall Street movement needs soon to start setting its sights on having some impact on some policy.
Let's go back to the phone lines right now. We have three callers who've been waiting very patiently. I promise we'll get to all of you. Our guest, of course, Greg Mitchell from TheNation.com, former editor and publisher magazine, author of numerous books, all of which are worthy of attention. Laura Flanders, host of Grit TV with Laura Flanders. And Laura, you've got a new TV show on public stations coming up?
Well, it's in the works. It's what they call in development.
But in development.
The Daily Show on hiatus in order to focus on a weekly show for public television stations that I hope will very quickly thereafter follow Bill Moyer's new show to public television. So if he starts in January, I hope that we'll be on the air at least by March.
Well, we will definitely be watching that closely. That's very exciting. Hopefully we'll have it on WILL-TV here
in
Champaign,
Urbana. Well, I hope that you'll help in making that happen.
We'll do our best. In the meantime, let's go to line one, one of our favorite callers, Champaign County. You're on the air with Mitchell and Flanders.
Yeah, excellent. My suggestion, I don't know if it's medium or short-term or long-term, is to advocate a financial transaction tax, with the head of the EU wanting one and the UK apparently already having one in some form. It would be an excellent thing to advocate for. But I'm going back to the choice of Zuccotti Park, and it wasn't because billionaire Bloomberg's squeezes on the holding company that owns the place, the building, but they actually were trying for Chase Plaza, if I recall. Amy Goodman has a good podcast on this where she recounts the donation by J.P. Morgan Chase to the police, and then the closing of this park, which was apparently the first site. It's an amazing story. Maybe I've told too much already, but I wanted to also go back to WikiLeaks, and maybe I'll read this on your blog if you don't want to do it now, if you could find out something about this. But there was a rumor that at the turn of the year, there was, I forget when it was, but there was going to be a major whistleblower from inside the financial system.
Yeah.
It was B&A, I thought, but I'm not sure about that. But that's been stalled, and apparently there's some heavy-duty legal and financial machinations that are behind the fact that hasn't been dumped yet. And that's a link that I couldn't help think of when you were talking about it earlier.
Well, that's a great comment, line one. Thank you so much. Greg Mitchell, I could see already you're ready to dive in. Please, let's a financial dump from WikiLeaks right now would be the equivalent of sort of throwing a match on the world.
Yeah. Well, I wish I had had more information on it. You know, certainly hyped, last year. It gave a lot of people hope. People kept expecting it. And there's, wide disparity of views about it. Some people have said it was always overhyped. Some people say that the WikiLeaks critic, Daniel Domscheit-Berg, sabotaged it or took it with him. It no longer exists. Some people have said that it's interesting, but there's no smoking guns there, and it was, never as it wasn't as great as people thought. Assange has said he's not even clear that WikiLeaks has it and can even release it. So, it's too, maybe Laura knows more about it. I don't know, but everything I've followed on it, it's very, very murky, and I wouldn't give out much hope now that it's really going to surface.
Okay, Laura,
yeah,
do you know anything about
this? No, I don't. I've been kind of wishing that Greg could produce one.
Well, Laura, let me ask you a question to follow up your earlier comment on a demand for publicly financed elections. In a way, if you look at this huge wave of demonstrations in the United States and globally, but say in the United States, starting in Wisconsin this past winter, and now moving nationally in the Occupy USA movement. And how much of this do you think is just due to the fact that with this huge increase of money coming into the electoral system now, that that whole electoral system increasingly looks like it's completely rigged, that it's precluding popular involvement? And this, in that context, there's really no other option but going out in the streets.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it looks like it's rigged. It's rigged. I mean, let's face it. We have an electoral system where you look at any given state and the impact of corporate money, anonymous corporate money in the 2010 elections, the first elections since the passage of Citizens United, or the decision in Citizens United, and you see that money wins, money speaks, not in every race, but statewide, particularly when the lower profile races received massive influxes of money, whether you're looking at the state of North Carolina was written up recently by Jay Mayer in the New Yorker magazine. Sure, it didn't work in the governor's race in California, but that was pretty unusual. You've seen already this tremendous impact. And I think that, again, going back to the difference between 2006 and now, I think a lot of people, as I said, sort of held their nose and got involved in the election of 2008 for a variety of reasons and watched what happened. And the most charitable view is that the electoral system makes it almost impossible for progressive change to happen. And a massive money-driven faux populist movement on the right was able to take hostage our electoral system because their needs served the needs of the status quo powers. It was a perfect sort of sync-up there. But the populace who had been to the left of Obama, who wanted to see a more progressive direction taken, saw that their president, who they had had hope for a moment there, that their president couldn't make the kind of change or was never maybe going to make the kind of change, that maybe they'd been conned or whatever the history was, the present was, it was completely stymied. And in fact, you saw direction go in the movement go in the opposite direction. So I think it's no coincidence that Occupy Wall Street breaks out just as the money media and the status quo political system want to head off happily into another election. If nothing else, Occupy Wall Street is a massive screaming bell saying no more business as usual. We're not going through this charade again.
Our guest, you just been listening to, Laura Flanders, joining us from, I think, New York City.
You're right.
Greg Mitchell joining us from New York, greater New York metropolitan area. They've been talking this whole hour, or most of the hour, about the Occupy Wall Street, Occupy USA. We have a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently. Let's get to them right now. Let's start with line two, Monticello. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Professor. Anyway, I just wanted to let people know, I don't know, I might have missed it, maybe you mentioned it, that there is Occupy Champaign-Urbana. And, excuse me.
Excellent.
And over the
Yeah, please go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, these cell phones are hard to deal with. And anyway, over the last 2 weeks, there's been rallies. The first one last week, of course, started in front of WEFT-FM, our local community radio station. And it started at 11:30 and marched through downtown Champaign to the Chase Bank, where there was a few speakers and a lot of people there. I think there was at least 100. And a fairly large group of them went into the bank and presented withdrawal slips, probably it was $94.7 billion, the equivalent of the Chase's bailout. And yesterday, we started again at WEFT and marched to Westside Park, where they have the large gazebo structure. And there were speakers, Iraq Veterans Against the War, International Socialist Organization, service employees, Jobs of Justice, Champaign County Healthcare. There was music. And I'd say there was 200 to 300 people at that one. And if anybody wants to find out more, there is a Facebook page. There may be web pages. I would just Google Occupy Champaign-Urbana, and you'll probably find it.
And Greg, it sounds like this might be something you'll want to get up on the website.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I'll check it out when we get off here. But there, it's as I said earlier, it's staggering what's going on. My little town where I live here, just north of New York, had a rally 1 week ago, and they had 200 people show up, which was, I don't know, 10% of the population, I think. But it's just, you know, whether it's Boise, Idaho, the L.A. Times today has a story about a woman in Alaska. One woman occupied the tundra.
Uh-huh. Fabulous picture. Have you seen
photo of her and the dog? So, I mean, it's incredible. Whether it can be sustained or how it may be changed or what it's going to look like 2 months from now, you know, nobody knows. But it is it's an incredible grassroots. You know what it reminds me of a little bit is the anti-nuclear weapons movement of the early 1980s, yeah. The Freeze campaign, which I was very involved in. It was similar to that, the totally different types of people, a lot of suburban mothers and so forth, but also people who were not that, without a long history involved in politics. These were not mainly old lefties or anything like this. These were people who were just fed up and alarmed and scared about the nuclear weapons buildup of the early 1980s, and went out, and practically every town in the country had a Freeze group and had people agitating. So this is somewhat similar to that in some ways.
And just a footnote to that, of course, is that was really, that Freeze movement was, I think we have to say, one of the last truly successful grassroots-driven internationalist movements that we've seen. We've certainly seen progress on lots of issues, but that was one that I think we have to hold up as a major victory that persuaded change in the White House. Didn't accomplish everything that it wanted, but it did establish a Freeze for a while.
Well, it was similar also in the sense that, I mean, it did eventually have some goals, and then the Freeze did have a legislative goal and, stopping building new weapons. And there were successes and defeats when it started focusing on Washington. And some people at the time said, well, they never should have focused on Washington. Mm-hmm. But what they did accomplish was they changed the mood so much was that the arms race was stopped dead, both in the U.S. and the Soviet Union, just from popular, with this expression of popular will and the expression of how absurd the arms race was and how costly it was and how dangerous it was. And it was more that change of mood, change of media mood, that really created real change, although you can't point to something that was passed in Congress or anything like that.
Well, you can point to the SALT II treaties. You can point to, yeah, to Reagan having to start talking about arms control. I mean,
right.
I think you're absolutely right that in that sense, at that moment, people said mutually assured destruction is a strategy we're in favor of.
I hate to at that point.
And I think in this moment it's kind of like, wait, too big to fail makes sense? This doesn't make sense. And I think it was a sort of common sense rejection of something that was being accepted by the status quo establishment, media, pundits, politicians, in a very similar way to the discussion we're getting now, that there's austerity for us and not for anyone else, and the public workers are the problem. Public finally saying, wait a minute. Stop. You guys have lost your minds.
Let's go to our final caller, and hopefully we'll have time for you at line 3 in Champaign. I apologize for the delay.
Hi. I'll keep it short.
Good.
I just want, I think perspective needs to be here. I think Obama, when he got into office, was given huge mountainous problems. And for anybody, that was really a challenge. And he's working in a system that doesn't work. Not to mention the fact that the second point is there's nobody to blame but us, the citizens. If we want it changed, then we need to be educated. We need to read and listen, check our sources. And that's all I have to say. Maybe he'll do some of the things we want him to do if we push him and if we get behind him. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Greg, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think she's right, but it is that's what I mentioned earlier, where there's a sense that for the time being, what we feel is that this expression of popular will is going to have some sort of impact on stiffening the spines of the Democrats and other allies to come up with new things or push for things they've already caved on in the past. That we're going to get some more change out of that while we look for larger changes.
Unfortunately, I hear the band tuning up in the background, Greg Mitchell and Laura Flanders. I could listen to you two talk. I don't have to be here. I let you guys take over. You guys are great. This has been a wonderful show. Thank you so much. I know you're very busy now, and to take time off for our listeners is really, we're very flattered. And thank you both for joining us today.
Great to be here. Anytime. Thank you.
And I want to thank Melissa Trent for doing a bang-up job as producer this week, Kyle Krohoff for doing the engineering as always. And remember, everyone, 166 hours from now, we'll be on at noon next week for the special two-hour Pledge Drive show. We're going to have John Nichols here for the full time. We're going to be talking politics, talking media, and raising money for this wonderful station. Thank you all. Have a great week.
Support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.